Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. I'm your host, Pat Reilly, for tonight's edition. My guest is Blaine Proctor, who is CEO of Save Inc. here in Kansas City, whose mission is to provide comprehensive housing solutions to empower socially and medically disadvantaged people to improve their health and lead stable lives with dignity. Blaine, thank you for taking the time to come and talk with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for the invitation.
How long has Save Inc. been around? I noticed it's been a while, and it started off with a little bit of a different purpose years ago.
Sure. We've been around since 1986. We were founded in response to the AIDS epidemic. Back when a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS pretty much had an underlying message of you should probably go put your affairs in order. You probably don't have a lot of time. And the stigma of the disease was causing folks to lose their homes and their jobs and their families. A group of volunteers came together and said, we need to give these folks who have lost everything a place to die with some dignity and some care. So Save Home was founded.
Save Home? And who founded that? What was the organization or the group that got together to get this started? How did they take on that process? Because I know late 80s, early 80s, we had Ron Reagan and all of the AIDS epidemic and the HIV epidemic that was ignored at the national level at that time.
Sure. It was a group of it was a kind of a cross section of folks here in town. It was some members of the Kansas City gay community, as mm-hmm. well as a few people from the faith community. And the name of the organization at the time was Good Samaritan Project. And then it became Save Inc. later on.
Gotcha. There's several different programs that that Save Inc. uses. First off, you've got a nice little complex. Can you talk about that? There's over at 30th and Harrison.
Sure. We loosely call this a campus. We own and manage 10 buildings here in Midtown Kansas City. Two of them are administrative buildings, and seven of them are permanent supportive housing residential buildings, and then one of them is Pride Haven, which is an emergency shelter.
And you have All Haven and Bodie, and Bodie is in the works?
Correct. All Haven is our newest building. It opened in October of 2021, and that is 50 units, and it pretty much doubled our inventory of supportive housing units here in Midtown. And then Bodie is a project that we will break ground on this summer, and it's 45 townhouse-style units on the east side of Kansas City, over at 39th and Jackson.
Interesting. What, as far as the All Haven goes, real quickly, is that open to a general public type situation, or is that for the folks that come through the Save Inc. program?
Both. 38 of the 50 units are what we call just strictly affordable. So anyone who is at or below 60% area mean income will qualify. 12 of the units, though, are set aside for transition-aged youth or 18 to 24-year-olds who have an HIV diagnosis.
I see. Getting to the programs and entry into the Save Inc. program or the Save Inc. Operation, one of these is the managed properties that you have. I assume All Haven would fall under that classification?
That's correct.
Okay. You said the 60% of the, was it the poverty level? It was 60% of earnings level? Was that it?
No, area mean income.
And how is that determined?
It's determined by the federal government.
I see. And is there a rough dollar figure on the top of your head of what that might be, just for information?
For an individual, it's going to be right. They consider poverty level to be $38,000, which is really pretty high, but it's what they've determined. And so anyone who is at 60% of that or below qualifies to live at All Haven.
Well, that's interesting, because even with the push for 20, or even push for 15, you know, that's only 30, 31,000 a year. So that's still essentially right at or just below the poverty level, isn't it?
That's correct.
Wow. But the managed properties themselves, let's talk about the inhabitants. Basically, the requirement is disabled in a specific way, either a person who has been diagnosed with HIV or AIDS, mental illness, or a substance abuse illness. But working with long-term case managers, does Save Inc. provide some of the case managers, or do you work with an outside agency to help determine those folks and the particulars for the managed properties?
Once again, it's both. We do have case managers and social workers on site who are working with folks to maintain their health so that they can maintain their housing stability.
Mm-hmm.
But many of the folks that we are that live with us are also taking advantage or utilizing medical case managers for whatever condition they have.
So it could be referral services from outside agencies too.
Correct.
Gotcha.
So
gotcha.
Folks that live with us in our managed properties go through an application process, just like you or I would do if we were looking for an apartment, and so they're able to, you know, they sign a lease, and they can have pets in their apartments. They they can live with us as long as they want.
I see. And this would be in some of the complexes there at 30th and Harrison.
Correct.
Gotcha.
We ask every one of our anyone who we serve to pay 30% of their income towards their rent.
Mm-hmm.
That is the amount that the federal government has determined. No one should pay more than that for their housing.
Mm-hmm. For affordable housing. Now, there's a voucher program too that helps out, but you go through a coordinated entry assessment program. Now, is that done with case managers there at your facility, or is, again, that's a combination of outside and inside?
Coordinated entry is a community-wide effort to determine someone when someone is experiencing homelessness or being unhoused. They go through the coordinated entry process, which is essentially an assessment to determine their vulnerability. So, for instance, a single teenage female who is expecting is going to rank higher on this vulnerability scale than, say, a 25-year-old healthy young male. And so then once they've gone through that assessment, they are placed on what we call the by name list, because it is literally a list of people who have been assessed and they're listed by name. And then several times a week, housing providers like us come together and they just start assigning these folks that are on this list to organizations that have, for instance, an open housing voucher or something like that.
So you work with some other entities here in town in order to get some of these folks placed. One of the things I saw is, must they be homeless?
They do need to be literally homeless, and that is something that HUD tells us that we have to determine.
I see. And do they have the same parameters as far as a diagnosis with HIV, AIDS, or mental health illness, a substance abuse illness, or is this like a general opening for a person who is experiencing an imminent situation?
For our rental assistance or our housing vouchers, yes, they have to have the same qualifiers that anyone in our managed properties have. But there are other vouchers out there where someone who is just simply experiencing, and I don't mean simply in a
right
in a positive way, but someone who is simply unhoused would qualify for those vouchers.
But obviously, it connects the highest need first.
Correct.
You have an emergency assistance program, too, that I found very interesting, and that would be for, again, we're going to the literally or imminently houseless or homeless like right now. Assistance not really guaranteed, but it does give them advantage of being listed, so if something opens, they can get something fairly quickly.
Sure. Emergency assistance is out there to help folks who are imminently going to lose their housing or have their utilities turned off or have perhaps been evicted from their home or their utilities have been turned off. So emergency assistance is something that we've always done. We've done it as long as almost as long as we've been around. But in the past, prior to the pandemic, we would get maybe 5 or 10 calls a month. After the pandemic started and folks were losing their jobs and facing evictions because they couldn't pay their rent, they were facing their utilities being turned off, or they had actually been evicted or had their homes foreclosed on, a lot of federal funding started coming into the communities to help stem that. And we were one of the agencies that started to help distribute those funds out into the community. And so the demand for that money skyrocketed. On our busiest day, when we after we started working on that all of that funding, we had 180 calls in one day.
Wow. And from what I understand, too, now some of those federal funds are starting to dry up again because the federal government has just basically taken away the coronavirus or emergency programs.
Yeah. You know, COVID-19 is no longer considered a national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So so most of that funding has gone away.
Are you starting, or have you started to see a little spike in the requests again?
We're still seeing a very high demand, but less of it is because of people losing their jobs due to COVID-19, and it's more people who are just, you know, facing homelessness.
Yeah, because I know I have been reading in some of publications that I get that some of the rental agencies and rental properties, now that is over and they don't have to abide by the federal rules where they can't essentially toss people out in the streets, you know, that is gone, and they're trying to take advantage of some of the stuff that they weren't allowed to do in the past. So I thought there would probably start being a little bit of an uptick in some of the displacement and forcing out of homes and rental units.
Yeah, there is definitely, you know, the demand is still there. During the pandemic, when we had a lot of those federal funds coming in, it was amazing to me how behind some of these people were and how much money they owed to landlords. I was signing checks for back rent for some of the people we were serving for $15,000-$20,000.
And just off the top of your head, how many people do you serve? What's your current population?
On an annual basis, we serve right around 1,000 households. When you look at total people, it's more like 1,300 or 1,400 people.
A part of the emergency assistance program, too, is some of the things that you help folks get and that helps them get through the everyday life. You know, you talked about the back rent, security deposits, and things like that. But, you know, IDs, driver's licenses, and that type of thing that, you know, basically everybody needs to get through a day or get a job or, you know, open a bank account, utility assistance, and all little things like that.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you can't even apply to live in, you know, for a lease unless you have some sort of identification. So we help folks get identification. Sometimes they need to get a copy of their birth certificate in order to get that identification. They may need help getting a Social Security card. So we can help them with all of that stuff.
And do you have staff there that, like, will help with economic issues, setting up bank accounts, working a budget, you know, all that kind of good stuff to help them, you know, progress through the system, you know, in a predetermined way, but in a normal way that some of the folks that don't have issues are able to do?
Yeah, we have staff on here, you know, our social workers and our case managers here. You know, that's really a big part of their job, is helping folks maneuver day-to-day life. And, you know, we have partners out in the community. We have a bank that we work with who pretty much has waived, you know, minimum deposits, and they're sort of a second chance bank for folks who perhaps don't have the best credit or don't have $200 to open an account, and they don't have to maintain a balance of a certain amount in order to keep their account open.
And in the long run, may be able to help with lending as they progress through the system, and, you know, get to a point where they're able to do something like that.
Sure, our goal is always to, you know, get people on a path forward that's only going to get better. When somebody comes to us who has what we call zero income, our first goal is to help them get income, whether it is through Social Security or some sort of a disability benefit or something like that. But that's one of the first goals that we have once we've gotten somebody housed.
Uh-huh. Now let's talk about Pride Haven. This is one that is of special interest to me because it's a topic that's not near and dear to my heart, but one that I have followed pretty extensively in the legislative process across the state of Missouri, and at the federal level, what we're starting to see. This particular program, from what I am understanding, is for transition-aged youths from 18 to 24 facing homelessness. And with some of the legislation that we're seeing at state, not necessarily local levels, although the city of Kansas City or Jackson County just passed a nice little resolution here a couple of weeks ago, but we're starting to see this particular age group and population marginalized severely.
Well, they've always been marginalized, but unfortunately, at the state and federal levels of government, we're seeing legislators pretty much target this population.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we mentioned that this these are transition age kids who identify as LGBTQIA. So, we're seeing legislators pretty much put targets on these kids' backs and take away rights, take away pretty much anything that helps them that's affirming and helps them identify the way they want to.
It is a safe and affirming space for all that you say this facility or this program is for. It provides case management, budgeting, gives them a safe place to come and be themselves.
Absolutely. We're very affirming. We've had young people come to us who have been at other shelters in the community where they were bullied or made fun of or even physically harmed because of how they identify through their gender. And this is a place where they're going to be affirmed, they're going to be able to identify they want, and they're going to be safe.
Now, I know there are some cities that have a large population of homeless folks that identify as LGBTQIA. How is that population here in Kansas City? What are you seeing as far as numbers of youth that are on the streets that are trying to wade their way through with this identification?
We don't have any firm data on how many young people who are unhoused out there identify as LGBTQIA. But I know that we have 20 beds in our shelter, and we turn young people away pretty much every day. There was a survey done last year as part of the Pride Festival, and it was pretty shocking how many of the young people that were surveyed had experienced housing instability and had experienced violence when they were on the streets.
Well, I would imagine, too, some are face that at home from unwilling or uncomprehending parental units and that type of thing, too. Are you encountering some of that type of issue here?
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons, probably the biggest reason, that we are seeing these young people show up at our door. They've been either asked or told to leave their home, and because of how they identify. And so, you know, we're trying to correct that.
It's amazing. It's amazing what we do to our own sometimes.
Absolutely. We've actually had parents deliver their kids to our door.
Wow. Don't want you any more disposable, huh? Terrible. You, as the organization itself, a couple of years ago, established a program, DEIB, mm-hmm. Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging. Tell us a little bit how that process went through your organization and the outcomes of that.
Well, it was as a result of things that we were seeing 3 years ago that were going on in the BIPOC community when it comes to violence against them and everything. You know, DEI became top of mind for most organizations and communities and countries, you know, everyone. We looked at it and we knew that we needed to embrace it, because we need to be reflective of the communities and the populations that we're serving. So we contracted with a local change-making organization to put our staff and our board through a 3-day training process, essentially, and around racism and inclusion and everything like that. And then we created a committee within the organization that's made up of staff and board members to make sure that we are carrying this through everything that we do. Mm-hmm. It should really drive every decision and every decision we make and every policy that we create. So the B, you know, the belonging, you know, you can tell someone all day long that we want to include you, and everything like that. But if you don't feel like you belong, you're really not included.
Isn't it interesting that some of the legislation across the United States, and particularly a couple of states that I can think of right off the top of my head, that are trying to limit governmental contracts with agencies and schools, universities, that are using and practicing DEI now?
It's become a major political issue.
You have a couple of events coming up here that are fundraisers for Save Inc. Got one in June coming up, a pickleball tournament.
Correct. You know, we're trying to jump on the pickleball bandwagon. Pickleball's become so incredibly popular. Actually, a couple of our board members play in several leagues, And so we have partnered with Chicken and Pickle up in the Northland for the last couple of years to do pickleball tournaments.
Cool. Entry forms or information available on the website?
It's just been put on our website this week.
Gotcha. Great. And in September, you have one of my all-time favorites, a kickball tournament.
Absolutely. We've done a kickball tournament annually, I want to say for the last 7 years. And once again, you know, it's a really popular game, and it we get 12 teams to come and participate, and it exposes us to a group of folks that typically wouldn't know about us.
Uh-huh.
It's on September 19th at Gillen Park.
September 19th at Gillen Park. How can folks get involved with Save Inc.? I know, like all organizations in town, you can always use some more help and volunteers. How do they reach out to you?
We have a volunteer sign-up spot on our website. You can just fill that out, give us your name, best way to contact you. And there's, you know, you can give us a call. Pride Haven looks for volunteers for different reasons quite often. And so there's any number of ways to get involved with us.
And what is the website?
www.savinkkc.org.
Savinkkc.org. Well, great. You might not see me at the pickleball tournament. I just don't have that mobility anymore, but I might be there for the kickball. That sounds like a lot of fun.
That sounds great. We'd love to have you there.
Well, folks, if you just tuned in, I was talking with Blaine Proctor, who is CEO of Save Inc. here in Kansas City. And the website again, Blaine?
www.saveinkkc.org.
Fantastic. Blaine, I appreciate your time very much, taking the time to come out and talk with us. Best of luck with everything at Save Inc.
Thanks so much for having us.
You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of Radioactive Magazine. Tune in next week to hear five members of PeaceWorks Kansas City discuss their work in Washington, D.C. last month with the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, asking our representatives in the U.S. Congress to stop making nuclear weapons.